Coming up this week in Computer Hardware, AMD Radeon Crimson Driver Update, 10-year warranty, thanks Corsair, new adaptive sync monitors from Asus, cheap laptops, and more. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 359, recorded April 14th, 2016. 10-year warranties and continued quality improvements.
This episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Braintree. Mobile app development can be complex, but integrating your payments no longer has to be. With Braintree, your business can accept nearly every type of payment from any device with just one integration. Learn more at BraintreePayments.com/Twitch. And by iFixit, introducing the all-new ProTech Toolkit to give you the compact and complete toolkit for all things DIY. For $5 off your purchase of $10 or more, go to iFixit.com/twit and enter the code TWITCH at checkout.
Welcome to Twitch This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that aims to bring you the most useful, most informative, most engaging, most delightful, and yes, ladies and gentlemen, most groundbreakingly progressive coverage of PC and mobile hardware to be found anywhere, at any time, anywhere in the future or past on Computer Hardware. I decided to see if I could do the most ridiculous... unlivable up to promise ever.
I'm trying to figure out what progressive coverage of computer hardware even means.
I don't know what it is either, but I'm sure I'm going to get some hate mail.
Defending the little guy, you know, the...
I have no idea.
Okay, all right.
Well, okay, what do we stand for? We love performance. We love performance. Yeah. That's a great deal.
Yep.
We're willing to get excessive and overspend for things that we think are worth it. But generally, we want to deliver the best, you know, the best performance for the best value. Whatever you
kind of cover every like possible political scenario involving computer hardware, I think.
Oh yes, because we're very political.
Right, we talk about that a lot on this show. So
I'm here like, yeah, you got $500, we'll build you a gaming machine. You got $2,500, we'll build you a gaming machine. But apparently,
that's right.
Social justice gaming machine builds. I'm not touching that. And now I've guaranteed I'm going to be getting hate mail.
Yeah, we don't want to get into any of that.
While we're acquiring hate mail, I got to spend some time over at the Tested office and finally got eyes and hands on the HTC Vive. Wow.
Yeah?
That was really cool.
Yeah, what'd you play?
The one I can't remember the name of, which is the Castle Defense with the arrows.
So you played the lab. You were playing the lab, yeah. And that was one of the mini-games.
I was in the lab.
Yep.
Space Pirates is pretty awesome.
Yep.
I really like the lab, really like Space Pirates, and they started me out with the underwater simulator.
The Blue, I think, is what it's called. Blue. Big whale comes by you and stuff.
Yeah, I was impressed. We also had some frame dropping issues, which was interesting. But we're not sure if that was something running in the background or something had gotten tweaked on that, because they are, I believe, running the sort of beta, the latest beta version of everything possible. So
something.
Some bit of code somewhere may have gotten a little bit excessive and
it's dramatic. Interesting. It's a complete side note here on our continued progression into testing the Vive. Sometimes you'll get like stutters or stalls from a lack of tracking, right? And it depends on your environment that you're in. The particular environment we are here in the office has some special thing that is wrong with it, where every once in a while we can kind of exactly reproduce a like a lost tracking of a controller or something like that. Meanwhile, when I took this exact same hardware to my house, when trying to reproduce some kind of lost tracking, I was not able to do it. I haven't heard any widespread reports of it, so I don't think it's a kind of a major concern, but it is something like to note of. If you're rotating, it stops rotating, it could be the game, it could be your system, it could be the tracking, like it could be actually the headset itself being monitored by all the rest of the hardware. So it just adds yet another potential fall for PC hardware testing and that type of stuff too. So always great to know.
Yeah, there's nothing like knowing there's, I don't know, it's an interesting process. It's very different. It's much more engaging than I expected it to be. Or hoped it to be, and of course, Job Simulator, which was a hoot.
Yes.
Those guys were laughing their asses off watching me screw around in Job Simulator. I found it incredibly compelling.
Yep.
Not running out to spend the cash on it yet, but
sure. Even if you could.
Yeah. Well, the other thing is that I really want the resolution to be considerably higher than it is. Our sympathies go out to.
There's still definitely like a screen door effect you see if you're not looking for it. I think it's there. A lot of people that say, "Oh, I don't notice it anymore," are either delusional or just don't know what it is they're looking for. And it becomes very apparent when you play a game like Project Cars or a racing game where you're looking at the horizon, you're kind of looking into the distance where the size of the pixels becomes even more apparent. So there's definitely a lot of room for improvement there. I don't think anybody that's making the hardware or is developing for the hardware has said, "Oh, this is the perfect resolution. We're going to stop here and move forward anymore." We just need screen tech, rendering tech to get a little bit faster, get a little bit cheaper before we can move on to that type of stuff.
Yes. Other than that, totally easy. Oh my goodness. AMD Radeon Crimson Edition drivers continue quality improvements. I don't want to say you're being a little cruel there, Ryan, but that's damning with faint praise or praising with faint damning. I mean, it's are you essentially saying they suck less than they did not too long ago?
I prefer the latter of those two options, right? That you put out there, right? So it's praise with faint damning.
That's the one.
So AMD kind of went out to some media people with this presentation and they wanted to talk about, hey, we're really proud of what we've done on the driver side and we want you to tell that story and we think it's compelling. And I listened to them and I agree a lot with a lot of stuff that they're doing. This started really a year plus ago when they released the Catalyst Omega driver. It was like this platform driver that came out. It had all these changes, had all these performance improvements. It had a bunch of feature additions. It looked the same at the time, but it was like, this is our starting point. And the problem was then, and we talked about it at the time, was that they really only planned like one thing per year, one major release per year, and then they were going to have these kind of iterations throughout. The problem after Omega was we didn't see the iterations that they kind of promised. And that kind of picked up towards the end of 2015 where they started releasing more drivers. And then in this first quarter, 2016, they released more drivers than they had ever in the past, right? So they released 7 drivers in 2016 already. That includes like hot fixes or, you know, game specific releases or Wickl drivers. They released 3 Wickl certified drivers, which is the Windows Hardware Quality Labs. I think that's right. Yeah. Which is basically it goes through like a Microsoft certification process. They did 3 in this quarter. Last quarter or last year during the same quarter, they released 0 and they only had 2 drivers in total, right? So they're iterating more frequently. They're adding features. They released the Crimson Edition last November, I guess it was, which is like a total revamp of how it looks. It's much faster. It's prettier. It actually is more functional. Mm-hmm. They've done a whole lot of stuff to improve their perception in the community, right? Like, that's what really matters, right? Is any one driver can be good or bad, right? NVIDIA will release a driver and it can be crappy. They can release a driver and it'll be great. And same for AMD. What you have to change is the perception that your drivers are consistently good and consistently timely, because that's what a consumer and enthusiast is going to base their purchasing decision on, not one single driver.
That's the standard that has been set by NVIDIA. I mean, let's just call that out. And they need to be... it's hard to change the perception. If you've had a few stumbles, if there's been complications, if there's been issues, then you have to work 80 times as hard to get the reputation for delivering solid, timely, useful driver updates. So,
when I was having this conversation with AMD, because you know they saw the story and they wanted it to be more positive than the writing turned out to be. The story they wanted to tell is, look, we're better than NVIDIA now. See, here's our proof. And I said that argument can work on a hardware release. You can be in second place on a Tuesday with your Radeon GPUs, and on Wednesday you can release a whole new series and be in first place. Right? You can win in performance. You can win in value. Right? Boom. Those are hard lines you can cross. With software, it's more of a how have you been doing over a recent period of time or a long period of time, right? Like it is sustained excellence. It's not something you can just flip a switch overnight and say, oh, look, we have a good driver now. It has to be, we have a history of good drivers with good features, timeliness, you know, solid game release windows, all that type of stuff. And I said, they're doing the right things. And I don't want them to like be discouraged that people aren't accepting of what they're doing. It's just, keep doing what you're doing and eventually people will notice. I think this summer will have the perfect combination of reasons to find this out. Pascal will be released. Polaris will be released. Everybody has new graphics cards. Everybody's going to have, there's going to be tons of new PC games. And it's the exact window of opportunity for AMD to consistently prove that their drivers are, you know, stable, timely, you know, crossfire supported, all those things that need to happen for a driver to be considered a good driver. And like I said, they'll have every opportunity throughout the rest of this year to really dive into that and home in on it. And if NVIDIA has more slip-ups and falls behind in performance or releases or, you know, stability, then you start to talk about, has AMD surpassed it? But I don't think we're there yet, but they're on the right path. And that's kind of what I wanted to get across with the story, not that they're less bad than they used to be, although that is one way of kind of looking at things, right?
I'm apparently feeling kind of cruel today, and I would like to apologize for listening right now.
No, it's fine.
No, actually, it's not, but it's gracious of you to say so. But what you are saying is, like, look, if you've been leery about buying an AMD card based on some of the issues with graphics support in the past, let it go. Give it a new shot. Give it a fresh shot.
Yep.
All right. Leanne Lee DeBuse, SFXL PE550 and PE750 SFF power supplies. Sebastian writes that they have rather unexpectedly announced a pair of SFXL power supplies with the 550 and the 750 small form factor PSUs. Are these the fully twee ones? They are the fully twee ones. And they're fully modular with ribbon cables, which I like a lot. Having recently, we did a cable... cable management build for Tech Thing, and I forgot what a nightmare it is to have a small like mini ITX case and to have all of the additional power cables hanging off a power supply and figuring out where to bury those. Pricing and availability not known as of yet, but they look good. And they're big for the application. 750 watt for an SFXL power supply seems excessive, or is that because of the power requirements for some of the heavier duty AMD cards?
I do think it feels excessive. I agree. 750 watts is a lot for a full size ATX power supply these days. I think if you looked at our $2,500 system build with a 980 Ti in it, and a 6-core processor, we recommended a 750-watt platinum power supply from Corsair. So it's really high. So it's impressive they can get all that power crammed into that form factor. If you look at that third picture where it's next to the ribbon cables, you get an idea of how small these power supplies are, right? But it may actually – so because these are coming from Lian Li, it gives you an idea of maybe what they are planning for their future case designs or what they have envisioned for future case designs, right? Being able to get a whole bunch of power into a specific either, you know, interesting shape and form factor or maybe just a super small form factor is obviously going to be one of their goals. Otherwise, it seems unlikely that they would have kind of gone out of the way to release their own power supply line specific to small form factor designs. So that's kind of what I would expect throughout the rest of the year is some scenario where these exact products are required in their designs. But, it's hard to complain about getting more in a smaller space. So,
yeah,
especially if they're modular cables.
Which one? It's not as tiny as like the single board Pico PSU power supply I'm using in the S4 mini case over here on my right. But you're talking about, you know, you end up cutting, an inch and a quarter off of, or an inch off one side, an inch and a half off the other side, and about 3/4 of an inch off the third dimension. So it's not a massive reduction, but it is a healthy reduction. And if you are looking for, if you're doing sort of an unusual DIY build, SFX PSU might give you a little more space to work with or a little more space to have to fill.
Right.
You know, they look really nicely built. I'll be really curious to see what the prices are when they come out.
I wonder, I guess I hopefully they're all aluminum builds. That's all, you know, Lee and Lee, that's what I expect.
The man has standards. Corsair's Angular Carbide Spec Alpha enclosure has been released. I was back and forth in this case at CES because it's striking. It is really striking. Like, this is one of those case designs, I think people see it and they either love it or they hate it, period. Yeah. Discussion. There's just not a lot of space in between. What's nice about something with this much style and color that pops visually as much as this does is it's $80 MSRP. Yep. Three-speed fan control built in there. Sebastian wrote this up at PC Per. No 5 1/4-inch drive bays. So no Rip Monster 4000 or 5000 build for me, but three 3.5-inch drive bays, four 2.5-inch drive bays, 7 expansion slots. It'll do a pair of 120-millimeter radiators in the front, a pair of 120-millimeter radiators in the top, a single 120-millimeter, I should say fan, not radiator, but radiator, two fans in the front, two fans in the top, one fan in the rear, a 240-millimeter radiator in the front, or a 120-millimeter radiator in the front or rear. Integrated dust filters, which I really have decided I like a lot for front and bottom intakes. Yeah. And a complement of ports, 2-year warranty. I like it. You know, it's got a very, like, you know, Star Trek reboot, something in the back corner that Scotty would be, you know, knocking right over his
eye. Yeah. I saw them at CES just like you did, but I don't have any firsthand experience with them yet. But it's important if you look at that middle photo. Internally, this is just a chassis, right? It's a square metal chassis, and all the kind of like angular dimension and color you get is really kind of extra flash added to the sides and front and that type of stuff. The it also looks a lot to me like if you saw the Corsair Bulldog case, yeah. It's kind of home theater design. Like somebody stood that up, repositioned the feet on the bottom, and said, mm-hmm. "Well, let's pull a little bit here on the plastic design and the CAD design and make it look a little bit different." And it's very much going after that same kind of style, right? And right. I remember at CES, Corsair said, look, this is a style that really appeals to like the Asia-Pacific markets more than the North American markets. But still, obviously, they got enough solid feedback from CES and from the news post that went up about it that they decided to release it over here as well. And like you said, the $79 price point is pretty aggressive as well. And if you're looking for something that's not just a cube or a square to fit on your desk, this will get attention and it will fit all of the stuff you need, unless the stuff you need includes optical drives, I guess.
Well, I don't know. It's been interesting for me to see how many cases no longer include optical drives. But then again, most people don't own 900 CDs and, you know, 100 some Blu-rays. So I have better media quality than they do, period. Moving on. Speaking of better quality, this episode of This Week in Computer Hardware is brought to you by Braintree. But next year, maybe even next week, there could be a whole new way to pay. Oh, you got the credit cards covered. You got the PayPal covered. You got the Venmo covered. You know, what about Aardvark 12? I made that one up. You can have it if you want to. That's the problem with mobile payments, right? You think you've got everything covered, and all of a sudden there's a new hardware spec, a new this, a new that, a new the other thing. Make your life easy. You know, it doesn't matter if it's the next Bitcoin, the next Apple Pay, maybe the next Apple Pay using Bitcoin and a new weird piece of hardware. That's what makes Braintree's full stack payment platform so good. It's easily adaptable to whatever the future holds, so you can adapt easily too. Pounds to PayPal, accept everything for that next big innovation from any device with just one integration. And when that new payment method comes out, all you'll have to do is update a few lines of code. No late nights, no complicated recoding, no weeping in the morning when you find your coders unconscious under their beds, tucked under their little blankies. Payments should be easy. You shouldn't have to be stressing about staying ahead of the curve and keeping up with the latest way to accept money from your customers. Braintree Payments is here to help. Secure, simple payments, code you can integrate quickly. The code supports Android, iOS, and JavaScript clients. They've got SDKs in 7 languages, .NET, Node.js, Java, Perl, PHP, Python, and Ruby, which means they are all up to date with the hip development environments. And people who understand code tell me it's elegant code with clear documentation. And if you don't know why that's important, you're probably not a coder. Or you're just too hardcore to admit that documentation can make your life easier and faster and smoother. Look, people, Braintree gives you an easy way to accept multiple payment types with one integration. Integrating it into your app is as easy as inserting a few lines of code. Make your life easier and learn more at BraintreePayments.com/Twitch. That's BraintreePayments.com/TWICH. And we want to thank them for their support of This Week in Computer Hardware. Now, go out. Make more money with less drama and trauma with BraintreePayments.com/Twitch. I'm just saying. Oh, my goodness. Other PSU companies hate them. Corsair's one weird trick to get you from a 7 to a 10. Sounds like something you'd find like 3/4 of the way down the webpage with a picture of an octopus or an attractive woman. Like one of those. That's the most clickbaity title I've ever seen.
Yeah, that's what Jeremy was going for specifically.
A little bit of love for Jeremy on that one. what they are talking about is the expanded warranty, right? The 7-year warranty is now 10 years.
Yeah, like just for nothing. Like just you don't have to fill anything
because
out.
Because they could. Because they cared. Because their power supplies are so badass, they're going to last forever in the terms of technology. Pretty sure it's 10 years considered forever now, right?
yes, and especially in computer hardware terms. I mean, is this something that for you would sway your purchase or recommendation decisions in one way or other? Like 7 years to me already seemed like a very long time period to have a warranty.
And
10 years is like extravagant.
I don't know. I mean, I had a conversation with my cousin about a Chrysler product he owned when we were much younger. And he said he didn't realize when he bought it that the warranty meant they would just keep replacing the crappy transmission over and over again, without it. It didn't cost him any money, but he kept losing his car for 2 weeks a pop. You know, every 8 months as the transmission, which was poorly engineered and poorly built, exploded and it had to be pulled and replaced again. So in that sense, you know, it's nice for companies to build a product that they will warranty for 7 or 10 years. You just want to not have to use the warranty ever. I think Corsair is doing a pretty good job building their products. I haven't had a problem with the Corsair power supply. I'm sure there are people who have, you know, once you get tens of thousands of people listening, somebody's had a problem with whatever product you mention. I think it's great, you know. I also think, I'll be honest with you, when you mentioned earlier, you know, how, you know, 500, 700 watt power supply, unless you suddenly go crazy pants and decide to triple, go to a triple GPU operation. You know, if they don't change the connectors on the motherboards and the GPUs, you might actually be able to use this power supply through 2 or 3 major builds. You know, especially if you've got, you know, something with all the modular cables and you don't lose all the modular cables, which might be difficult to not do over the course of a 7-year lifespan. But, I mean, think about it. I've got, you know, maybe I shouldn't be, but I've got at least one, you know, I think 500 watt power supply I've been using for 6 years. There's never been any problems with the system. There's never been any problem with the power supply. I haven't run it, you know, on an oscilloscope to verify the quality of the power, but it's working and I ain't fixing it. So, hey, go Corsair. Build stuff that doesn't fall apart.
Can't complain, I guess.
Well, you could, but you'd probably be silly. What's going on with Micron and Intel launching their Wave enterprise storage products?
So this was there was a lot of stuff that came out of that, and not a whole lot of it was consumer facing. If we look at like the specific consumer facing portions of this announcement,
we talked about that some with Alan, but Did he come up with any sort of, I should point that out. So, but there, were there any kind of revelations he came with after you know, flying home?
Not really, right? So this one was more of, hey, this is what we're showing in the future. They did show, they showed Crosspoint again. They talked a little bit about it. Alan's actually working on a news post now that from IDF. What's that? Oh, it's actually posted now, where they demoed Crosspoint running at 2 gigabytes per second copy speeds on at the IDF Shenzhen show. They had like the SSD 540S, which is a new consumer version. It's actually using a Silicon Motion controller and SK Hynix flash. It's not even using any of the Intel parts really in it. They did talk about the Micron MX300, I believe is what it was. Let me see if I got that right before I am misquoting. The MX300, which will be the first consumer product to use the Intel flash, the Intel Micron kind of flash technology, to use the 3D TLC NAND. And Alan pointed out that it was interesting that they went straight to TLC instead of using MLC. So the idea here is that they're going to be very aggressive on pricing. Right. That's why you would jump to TLC. And, you know, we don't really know anything. They didn't talk about the performance side of it. And they didn't talk specifics about pricing, really. But we do know that if they're jumping straight to TLC, that means that their goal here is aggressive on pricing. I mean, you look at some of the past, like, Micron releases in the SSD world in the past couple of years, you'll see that's kind of the path they've been on as well. They'll still have MLC, but it will be in a different product line, whether it be a different consumer product line later, or maybe they keep it only in enterprise markets. You know, it could be either or none of the above.
Okay.
Yeah.
Either or none.
Yeah. I mean, other than that, you're looking at a whole bunch of enterprise level stuff, SSDs, for data
super
centers.
Ridiculous, badass SSDs that.
Yeah. There was one that was interesting. The SSD DC D37 and D36, they're PCI 3.0 U.2 designs. Like, so the more interesting PCIe NVMe connection that Intel used at the 750 series. But it actually has a dual port design, which means that you can actually connect a single SSD through a special backplane to two different systems, to two different computers in a single U.2 connector. And this is more for redundancy, as only one system can actually access the drive at any given time. But it allows you to, one system can fail and the same flash storage will be available to the failover system without having to worry about copies or duplications and that type of thing. So it's an interesting kind of, again, enterprise class design aspect to it that was neat to see. Something you really couldn't do with a SATA implementation that you can do with a PCIe implementation.
Good to know.
Yeah.
Asus has announced three new monitors from the Republic of Gamers division, all of which feature adaptive sync variable refresh rate displays. Sebastian's got the write-up on PC Per. They got a 28-inch model, the MG28UQ, and a pair of 24-inch displays. That's the 24-8Q and the 24-UQ. The 28UQ, or the MG28UQ, is a 28-inch UHD 4K display featuring a 1 millisecond response time. Inputs include DisplayPort 1.2, one HDMI 2.0, and a pair of HDMI 1.4 ports. That is a lot of input. One of the 24-inch displays, Sebastian writes, is also UHD 4K, but just features an IPS display and consequently loses the 1 millisecond response time of the 28-inch version.
Right.
And 24-inch 4K display seems really pixel dense to me. And then the 24-inch MG248Q, which offers a 144Hz refresh rate and 1 millisecond response from its TN panel, but offers only full HD or 1080p resolution. Quote, though still adequate for gaming, especially at higher detail settings, depending on your preferences.
Yep.
Pricing information on these yet?
Nope, of course not. Actually, the 28-inch 4K, yeah, actually, one of them is already available now. The 28-inch 4K TN panel is $549, I think, on Newegg as of today. And apparently, it's been on sale for several weeks. They just haven't kind of done a formal announcement, I guess, for it. So it's interesting. I find it really compelling. So they're adaptive sync monitors, which mean they support variable refresh technology as part of the DisplayPort 1.2a plus standard. But they're not labeled FreeSync monitors, which is kind of interesting to me. And right. So I don't know if there is a political reason for that, or if there's a technical reason for that, or maybe they just didn't have time to get AMD to do the FreeSync certification before they wanted to make this announcement. It just seems odd to me that that they call out Adaptive Sync several times very specifically, but they don't mention FreeSync along with it. So, but in theory, these variable refresh rate monitors will thus only work with AMD graphics cards, unless with the Pascal launch this summer, you know, NVIDIA makes some kind of drastic turnaround in what they're supporting, or, you know, there's some new Adaptive Sync capability. These will only work on AMD graphics cards for the variable refresh portion, at least.
Ladies and gentlemen, you have been forewarned. USB Group steps in with software solution to rogue USB-C cables. Oh, boy. So right up on the Acquirer that Chris Merriman did. The trick is you don't want a USB-C cable to fry your gear. So the USB Implementals Forum writes, Chris has announced the, quote, USB Type-C authentication specification, which is a set of software-defined rules that a device can use to protect itself from potential sizzleage. concerns, it's funny, this kind of all starts with a Google engineer, Benson Leung, who was really frustrated with bad USB-C cables that were on sale on Amazon and led to the, quote, sacrifice of his 1,500-pound Google Pixel C. When I say 1,500 pounds, I don't mean to say that Mr. Leung is incredibly strong and carries around a small, you know, British sports car for a laptop, but that paid, you know, 1,500 pounds for it, or about $2,000 US. And it's frustrating, because they're just a lot of the cheaper USB-C cables are not prepared to handle the current that the format can carry. On the upside, Amazon is trying to stop the crappy cables, and they've added USB-C or USB Type-C cable or adapters that are not compliant with standard specifications issued by the USB Implementers Forum. That has been added to the list of prohibited electronics items, which, by the way, is kind of a fascinating and peculiar read if you've never been over to that.
Yeah.
What was particularly funny about this, an earlier article that Chris did back at the end of March, or Mr. Merriman did at the end of March on the Inquirer, quote, OnePlus, one of the first smartphone makers to adopt the new standard, offered a voluntary refund to customers after it was discovered that its bundled USB-C cables didn't make the cross-compatibility grade, although they work fine on the devices for which they were made, which is a way of saying a cell phone is not drawing as much wattage as a laptop. And if you have, 100 watts being pulled through a cable that was designed for 5 or 8 watts, you're probably going to run into trouble.
Right. I mean, do you think this is a good idea, or do you think it's like an unnecessary, potential struggle for these types of accessory vendors to go through?
I think it's, it is one of the challenges with USB-C. I'm trying to double check the maximum power on USB Type-C, which of course is not leaping. I want to say, because I thought it could carry a full 100 watts, right?
Yes, I think there was some mention about some 50 watts specifically in this particular case, but I don't know what the justification was for. I think that's just maybe the most common implementation at this point.
But the point being is that if things go wrong, they can go really, really wrong.
Well, there was the guy on Amazon that worked for Google that was reviewing USB Type-C cables on Amazon.
That's the man I was talking about a second ago.
Would they work? And then you fry your own stuff. You're like, yeah, maybe I'm going to not do that anymore type of thing. But idea of this makes a whole bunch of sense.
$1,500 laptop.
Yeah.
So,
it's unfortunate that this is even kind of maybe a requirement for this to work as well, or maybe it's more of an oversight their part that it was going to be necessary to do it and they should have done it at the beginning. And now it's going to be kind of difficult to retroactively go in and insert these kind of certifications and standards.
Be careful, you know, what cables you buy and where you get them from, especially if you're looking for a bargain, and try not to fry any of your gear.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. That makes sense to me.
Yeah. 100 watts at 20 volts maximum. So that's the, I don't know if anybody's currently using that, but that was the theoretical maximum they could offer on pulling power over USB type C. I think anything where people, if nothing else, if it gets the word out and it gets vendors more aware and retail operations more aware that they could, you know, help fry people's hardware, hopefully they'll work to keep products in stock that don't fry people's hardware.
Yep.
If your hardware is fried, though, people, our friends over at iFixit.com are there for you. I'm not laughing because iFixit is there for you. I'm laughing because, you know, I'm thinking of all the hardware I've fixed over the years. iFixit.com is your complete DIY electronics repair solution, from their 19,000 free step-by-step repair guides to their huge inventory of replacement parts and tools with lifetime warranty. iFixit has got your repair needs covered. It's good stuff, people. If you haven't seen it, the all-new ProTech Toolkit. I was just using it this morning to reassemble the enclosure around an ATI 1202 amplifier. I really like this update to the toolkit. One, black doesn't show the dirt from my terrible hardware drawers is the way the gray case did. The tools are easier to access. The bits are easier to access. It's got the new 64-bit driver kit that replaced the former 54-bit driver kit, which is held to the tool roll using magnets. The shell cover pulls off. You can basically like unroll the case, whip the cover off, and start using the bits. And if you pull the 64-bit driver kit off the base, you can use the magnetic pad inside the roll-up to hold the screws you're working on. Really nice precision driver is included in there. They've got the flex extension from the earlier driver kit. If you're dealing with hard-to-reach screws, electrostatic discharge-safe tweezers, a pair of reverse tweezers, a bunch of plastic opening tools, spudgers, and picks to work on tablets and smartphones, a suction cup for display assembly removal, a metal spudger, and iFixit's own rubber-handled Jimmy pry tool, which basically puts a big old handle on a flexible piece of steel to help you crack things open without permanently damaging them. And if you're the kind of person that runs an ESD strap, there's one in there so you can try to help keep from destroying gear with electrostatic shock. Look, kids, spudgers. It's backed by iFixit's lifetime warranty. And seriously, buy it because it's awesome, or don't. You still get free access to all the free repair resources on iFixit.com. But if you do, you will know that you are helping to support the creation of more DIY step-by-step repair guides, which is pretty freaking awesome. Grab yourself an all-new ProTech Toolkit and get going on your next fix, your next hack, your next build. Just head over to iFixit.com/twit and use the code TWICH at checkout to save $5 on your purchase of $10 or more. We want to thank iFixit for their continuing support of This Week in Computer Hardware. And if you want $5 off your next purchase of $10 or more, there's some nice tools over there, by the way. That would be a healthy discount for. Go to iFixit.com/twit and use the code TWICH or Twitch to get $5 off on your next purchase. Good stuff, people. Go check it out. iFixit.com/twit. Oh, my goodness. HTC 10 reviews are out. Some people are a little down on it, but the general consensus is that HTC's flagship phone is now worthy of being called a flagship phone. It may not beat the Samsung S7 or the S7 Edge, but it is not an embarrassment, and HTC should be happy with itself. It looks nice. It looks clean. The performance seems to be solid. I want to call it is the ultra pixels they're using in the camera. You know, it's like a 5.2 inch quad HD display. Some interesting, basically, the idea is that it's got larger pixels for better low light performance. So the camera, yeah, the photos I've seen look pretty good. What you're looking at right now is a review with John over at Techno Buffalo. Well, that was a video of John for Techno Buffalo, the HTC 10 review up on Techno Buffalo by Brandon Russell. It seems to be solid. If you're an HTC fan, give it a look. I think the S7 is probably still in the lead for flagship Android phones. Got a great question from at Ryan Mister, or at Patrick Norton and at Ryan Trout. Are those 2 gigabyte RAM Chromebooks worth it? Or is a Windows 10 4 gigabyte laptop more usable for not much more money? We did we had some fun with a pair of a Chromebook and a Windows laptop that both cost a little bit under $200, both from Lenovo on Tech Thing not too long ago. And I was surprised at how functional a Chromebook with 2 gigabytes of RAM is. And I was surprised at how functional a sub $200 Windows notebook is. The $64,000 question is, does the Chromebook offer everything you need? If you just need, like, I need web browsing and document editing, and I'm going to listen to some music, and Bejeweled is cool. The Chromebook's awesome. If you are buying this, say, for a kid, and the kid likes to play Minecraft, you don't really want to run Minecraft on a Chromebook. You want to run it on a Windows laptop. Well, you know, you're laughing, but
No.
There are a lot of Windows applications. There are also a lot of stuff that runs perfectly fine on a Chromebook. Either one of them, I think, is a valid option. You are probably going to be more frustrated faster with a Windows laptop, or much, much more happier, which doesn't make sense until you realize that these are entry-level products. They work fine, but you don't want to try to do a lot of heavy multitasking with them in terms of the Windows laptops, especially if you're running like a Core i5, a relatively recent Core i5 desktop or something, where you'll have something to compare it to. Because if you have a very fast laptop, you're probably going to feel that the $200, $250 Windows laptop is a little pokey by comparison. If you're running an 8-year-old, Windows machine, you might think that that inexpensive laptop is ridiculously fast and awesome. Either one of them, the biggest challenge, I think, is the screen quality, which is considerably lower than any, $700 laptop out there.
Yeah.
And that's one of the places where they save a lot of money. I like them both. I would kind of put together a list of applications or things you need to do with the laptop and make sure all of them are offered on, for example, if you are choosing a Chromebook. But a lot of people seem to be really happy, and I have some friends that are specifically giving high-maintenance relatives Chromebooks because there's just... But you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
some
no,
people
I do.
Have
Trust
a natural
me.
Ability to, wipe out things or, click on websites they shouldn't have clicked on or whatever the terrible, terrible thing they run into is. And the Chromebook will eliminate a lot of that. And Google seems to be trying very hard to keep the Chromebook as secure as possible.
Gotcha.
This is a good one for you, sir. Mike Roberts, a.k.a. GNGR Ninja tweets, should I keep my 980 TIs or sell them and save for the new architecture? Is it too early to tell?
He says 980 TI, so he's running SLI. I mean, if you sell them now, what do you do until what product you're going to get? That's my first question, right? Or if this question is, do I sell the 980Ti's once Pascal is available? I think you wait, right? There's always the risk, I guess, if you're in that market that the value of the 980Ti will go down for you to sell it after Pascal is announced and released and people are able to buy it. And that's true. That's probably the case. But for me, I don't know. The 980Ti is a fantastic card. We don't know exactly what NVIDIA is planning. We have this idea that AMD's new cards are going to be kind of like mid-range first, and then they expand out from there. We don't really have any clue what NVIDIA is going to do, if it's going to be like ultra high-end first and then scroll down, right? And he's interested in the ultra high-end stuff because he's already got, the 980 Ti's. I would wait a little bit. I would say it's too early to tell. The new ones are going to be faster. They're going to be faster. They're going to do new things. And the excitement level, especially like on day one, will be to order, order, order. That's generally how these things sell out so quick. But I think look at reviews, wait for the analysis, and then make a decision there. There will always be people that will want 980 Ti's. You'll maybe get a little bit less for them. And you may decide that, hey, maybe NVIDIA only releases like the mid-range first, like the 980 class and not the 980 Ti class initially. And in which case, then you will have sold your product already and you're still, you know, I don't know what your backup plan would be for gaming in that meantime. It might be a month, it might be 2 months before you know what that new product is. So I tend to be, hold on to what you got now. You've got like the best single GPU product you can get. That's going to retain some value regardless. And then it's a little bit too early to tell about, is it time to upgrade yet? Is it time to start building up your eBay listing, I guess.
Sit on them.
Yeah. Yeah. Or game on them, maybe a little bit better.
Scott Forbes, a.k.a. Scott the Milkman, tweets, at Patrick Norton, at Ryan Trout, will VR headsets work with a Quadro M4000 card?
So I had to research what this was because I didn't know exactly what a Quadro M4000 was specification-wise. And it turns out it's almost exactly a match of a GeForce GTX 970. It's got 8 gigs of RAM instead of 4 gigs of RAM, but it has the same number of CUDA cores. And I believe they run at slightly lower clock speeds as well, he says as he goes between all of his tabs. See, 1050 on that one, and this one is, let's see, they don't list clock speeds on the Quadro cards in the same way that they do on the GeForce cards. I would say, where are we at here? 1664. No, they're not listing clock speeds at all here. It's probably a little bit lower than what you're getting on the GTX card. And the GTX 970 is the minimum kind of recommended spec for both Oculus and HTC. Uh-huh. I think you'll be able to run it on this. The only kind of hurdle, like, I think the hardware is there to do it. I think the hurdle might be is, does the Quadro driver have support built into it for the Rift and the Vive? And I don't know the answer to that. That's probably something you could get an answer for pretty quickly by either downloading the driver, looking through, you know, support documents or release notes or something like that, or looking on NVIDIA's own forums. But I don't, that would be my only hiccup is like, you have to have the driver to support those VR headsets in order for that to work. I would imagine that they do. I can't think of a reason why they wouldn't, you know, except, you know, they're more careful about validation and qualification on the Quadro side than they are with just the GeForce side. So I would look into that first before making an investment in either headset.
All right. Sounds like a good plan. John M. aka at Liquid Retro tweets, I am looking for an LGA 1151 motherboard ATX, probably for $6,700K. Something good but affordable. I am primarily a photographer, but computer will be used for some gaming and general use too. What's your favorite 1151 motherboard right now?
In our mid-range build, our mid-range VR build, our $1,500 VR build, we used an Asus Z170A motherboard, and I believe it's about $160 or so. So it's not cheap. You can definitely get lower cost boards that will support that processor. You can get H170 boards that will support that processor.
Well, I think it's down to like $140 at this point. The
Z170. Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, that's kind of like the Asus entry level Z170 board. But one thing about not just Asus, but MSI and Gigabyte have done this for a while too, is like you kind of get like a baseline stability, overclocking capability and feature set at even their lowest price kind of offering with that chipset. And then the stuff you add above that is really kind of, do you need it, right? So if you can look at the Z170A board, it's like, does it have enough USB 3.0 ports for what I need? It has two USB 3.1 ports. You know, it's got one M.2 PCIe slot. There are motherboards that have more than two or more than one. You know, you can get two of those. Do I need that? I think for the vast majority of people, that low cost $140 Z170A board is the way to go. Right? It's going to be the option that I think stands out.
Also, take a look at some of the options when you're looking at motherboards. M.2, U.2, NVMe support. It's been interesting to see kind of how all over the map the support for some of that has been. Oh my goodness. Yeah, and it's amazing how much motherboard you can get on Z170 for not much money. With that, ladies and gentlemen, we should probably wrap the show. And thank you, each and every one of you, for listening. If this is your first episode of Twitch, do us a favor. Head over to twit.tv/twitch. And you can find all of our older episodes and more information about the show and RSS feed links or iTunes links to get it automatically sent to your mobile device, your phone, your smartphone, your computer, your desktop, your laptop, wherever you like to listen to podcasts or watch them. And you can find more Ryan Shrout at PCPer.com. You can find it myself at TechThing.com or AVXL.com. And we want to thank all of you for listening. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
See you next week on Twitch.